You sabotaged my ass, society, and the cops, and the system. A raped woman got executed. It was used for books and movies and shit.
That was a portion of an interview with serial killer Eileen Wuornos, who was linked to the murders of seven men across Central Florida nearly 30 years ago. She was right about that last part. A year or so after her execution, her life story was depicted in the well-received Hollywood film Monster, which garnered an Academy Award for Charlize Theron, the actress who played her. The true story of the life and crimes of the real-life monster, Eileen Wuornos, is coming up on Sun Crime State. I'm Tony Holt, crime reporter for the Daytona Beach News Journal. Welcome to Sun Crime State, a true crime podcast that takes an in-depth look at Florida's biggest crime stories of the past and present. This episode will be about the troubled and violent life of Eileen Wuornos, who 17 years ago this month was executed at Florida State Prison in Rayford. Wuornos' behavior was so beyond the norm, her crimes so heinous, and her appearance so startling that Hollywood made a full-length feature movie about her, as well as a made-for-TV movie. Countless books have been written and documentaries have been shot about her. She is easily among the most infamous serial killers in Florida history. Wuornos was arrested in January 1991 at The Last Resort, a biker bar on US 1 in Port Orange, just outside Daytona Beach. Wuornos' subsequent court appearances bolstered her notoriety even more. My special guest for this episode will be defense attorney and former prosecutor David Damore, former Volusia County Sheriff Bob Vogel, Ocala Star Banner reporter Joe Callahan, and former Star Banner reporter Laura Burns.
It was difficult because we had a body. There was some belief that there might be a suspect, but we had no evidence, nothing to secure identification. DNA was not what it is today. There really was no chance for fingerprints because the body was decomposed and it was not the kind of crime scene in which fingerprints would be found. So very rapidly that case went cold.
That was Daytona Beach defense attorney David Damore, who in 1989 was an assistant state attorney for the 7th Judicial Circuit. He prosecuted homicide cases, and it appeared that the slaying of a Clearwater man in northern Volusia County was never going to lead to an arrest. On December 13, 1989, the body of 51-year-old Richard Charles Mallory was discovered near the intersection of U.S. 1 and Interstate 95 near Daytona Beach. Mallory owned an electronics store in Clearwater and was about 160 miles from home. 12 days earlier, Mallory's car, a beige 1977 Cadillac, was found in the woods near John Anderson Drive in Ormond Beach, about 5 miles from where the body was found. Mallory was shot in the upper body with a .22 caliber pistol. His body was covered with a piece of rubber carpet runner and some palm fronds. Two people searching the woods for scrap metal came upon his body and then called law enforcement from the nearest Exxon station. One of the witnesses noticed a buzzard pecking away at something underneath the rubber, expecting it to be an animal carcass of some kind. But after a closer look, he noticed a human arm underneath the piece of rubber. The victim's pockets were turned inside out. Based on the body's decomposition, it appeared he had been killed nearly 2 weeks earlier, on or around November 30th. In spite of the decomposition, authorities were still able to identify the body through fingerprint analysis. Mallory was the first victim. No one suspected he was going to be the first of a series of victims murdered by a female serial killer. The scene itself made some investigators wonder whether Mallory was a victim of the local drug trade. At least that's what's been mentioned on at least one documentary about the Wuornos murders. But David Damore doesn't remember it that way.
I don't know that that was the assumption, candidly. At least it wasn't with me. I have no recollection of that being the case. If I recall, I think there were some condoms in the area, some indication that there had been some type of sexual encounter out in the woods. But we didn't know whether it was heterosexual, homosexual, bisexual, you know, no clue.
Mallory's murder would remain a mystery for a while. Investigators went to Clearwater to search for answers. He lived for 3 years in a small apartment off U.S. 19. All of Mallory's contacts were in and around Clearwater. As far as the Volusia County Sheriff's Office knew, he didn't know anyone in Daytona and didn't have any reason to go there. He didn't even have that many friends in Clearwater. He was known as a barfly and never entered any of those bars with any friends or companions. He liked strip clubs in particular. Mallory owned a television and VCR repair business in Palm Harbor, just north of Clearwater. He was in massive debt, and more of his customers were growing impatient with him because he hadn't repaired the items they had paid him to fix. One of his employees helped him lock up the business around 6 p.m. on November 30th. An hour later, he had left a phone message with that same employee. Detectives concluded that about 12 hours later, Mallory's car was parked in a patch of woods near Ormond Beach. There were no keys or luggage left in the car.
They checked his business, they checked his home, they checked some of his companions. For a while, it was thought that this woman and man had killed him, who he associated with in Tampa. They ultimately got ruled out. She was a stripper because he hung out in those circles. You know, was he coming over here to go to some of the strip clubs? Not that far-fetched. Spend the night at a hotel. Maybe find a woman, shack up. I don't know. But you're right. He was a loner. You know, he was a kind of a appliance repairman, TV repairman. Didn't have a big social life whatsoever.
For 6 months, the murder of Richard Mallory seemed like an isolated slaying and one that would never get solved. The next death was reported in June, clear across the state, in Chasawitzkan's Citrus County. David Spears, a 43-year-old Orlando-area man, was found June 1, 1990. He was an equipment operator in Sarasota, but his permanent address, according to the media, was in Winter Garden. He had last been seen leaving work May 19th, so just like Mallory, his body had been lying for weeks before it was discovered. Spears drove a custom pickup truck, which was found abandoned and with a flat tire in Marion County, near County Road 318 and Interstate 95. Marion, which borders Citrus, would be the killer's main playground. The autopsy showed that Spears had died from a gunshot wound. Investigators in Citrus were just as perplexed about this case as Volusia investigators were about the Mallory killing. Nobody knew why Spears, who lived near Orlando and worked in Sarasota, wound up in Citrus, a good 80 miles from his home and 120 miles from his workplace. No one had connected the Spears murder with the Mallory murder. There was no evidence linking the two. The third victim in the killing spree was Charles Sonny Carskadden, a 40-year-old part-time rodeo worker who was shot and killed in Pasco County, north of Tampa. Carskadden was from Missouri. He had been shot 8 times, and his body, which was also found badly decomposed, was wrapped in an electric blanket. It took months before authorities identified Carskadden's body, which infuriated his mother in Missouri. She told the media it should have been easy enough to identify him considering his car was found near Wildwood, a city in Sumter County, which borders Marion, around the time Carskadden's body was discovered. By the time authorities finally did identify Carskadden, they suspected he was the victim of a serial killer. At that point, they thought maybe there were two serial killers on the loose, both of them women. They would be dubbed the Angels of Death. More on that later. Carskadden was driving alone from Missouri to Tampa to pick up his girlfriend, who was going to accompany him back to Missouri, where he had a job waiting for him. He was going to be a press operator. Carskadden was killed before he even got to Tampa. The fourth victim was Peter Sims, a 65-year-old retired merchant seaman who was active with a Christian outreach ministry. His gray 1988 Pontiac Sunbird was found July 4th on a rural road north of Ocala, the biggest city in Marion. Authorities found the car, but never the body. Sims lived in Jupiter in Palm Beach County. According to the Palm Beach Post, his plan was to visit his mother in New Jersey before heading south again to Arkansas to visit his son. He was expected to wind up in Alabama to join a missionary group there. When Sims' car was found, it appeared to have had a blowout. Its license plate had been removed, and it had obviously been involved in some type of crash because it was filled with broken glass. 2 weeks earlier, Sims was supposed to have called his German-born wife, who was visiting her son and relatives in Europe. She never got that call. When she called to reach him, she could never get a hold of him. 3 days after that scheduled phone call, Sims was reported missing by his niece. The fifth victim was Troy Burris, a 50-year-old sausage salesman from Ocala. He had only lived in Ocala for about a year. Before that, he was living in Delray Beach, also in Palm Beach County. His body was found August 4th in a wooded area near a rural highway in Silver Glen Springs in Marion. His body was found about 7 miles from where his refrigerated truck was located. He had been shot twice. The news reports following all of the aforementioned slayings stated nothing about any of them being linked to the same killer or killers. That would change not long after the news broke about the sixth victim. Charles Dick Humphreys, a 56-year-old retired Air Force officer and former police chief, was found dead near Ocala on September 11, 1990. He had been shot 6 times in the head and torso. His vehicle was found in Suwanee County, about 100 miles northwest of Ocala. Humphreys was last seen September 10th, leaving his office in Wildwood on his way home to Crystal River in Citrus. At that time, he was a supervisor with the Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services. He was a child abuse investigator for that agency. Humphreys was born in Detroit and had moved to Crystal River in the early 1980s from Sylacauga, Alabama, where he had been a chief of police. He served in that job for 2 years. He was also a veteran of the Korean War and was a military police officer while in the Air Force. He had a wife, a son, and 2 daughters. The Tampa Tribune published a story September 15th stating that the investigators still hadn't determined a motive for Humphreys' killing, but they were checking for possible links with at least 2 other slayings in the rural areas of Citrus and Pasco counties. The 2 murders authorities had in mind were Spears and Carskadden, even though investigators still had not identified Carskadden at that point. But based on where the bodies were located and the manner of death, investigators in Marion were starting to suspect all 3 men were killed by the same person or persons. On September 19th, the St. Petersburg Times published a story saying detectives were starting to think Sims' disappearance was also linked to the deaths of Humphreys, Spears, and Carskadden. There was 1 more murder in 1990. Gino Walter Antonio, a 60-year-old trucker from Cocoa, was found dead November 19th in Dixie County, located about 90 miles northwest of Citrus. His body was partially naked, and he had been shot 5 times. Antonio's vehicle was found 200 miles away in North Brevard County on Thanksgiving Day. Antonio was a reserve deputy sheriff. That's 7 murdered men in less than 12 months. 2 victims were found in Marion, 1 in Dixie, 1 in Citrus, 1 in Pasco, and 1 in Volusia. The body of one of the victims, Peter Sims, was never found. The public's perception, perhaps helped shape by Warnes' own statements, is that every victim was involved in a sexual activity with their killer, or they had sought sex from her. David Damore told me that might not have been the case for all of them.
Her M.O. seemed to match what a male serial killer was. She did turn the tables on these men, brutalized them, exploited them.
I don't disagree with any of that. They were brutal. and brutalized. She did exploit them. She did take advantage of them. And she took advantage, really, what one of men's biggest weaknesses are, sexuality. You know, women have been able to control men and their behavior since the time of Adam and Eve, you know, sexually. And these folks, unfortunately, were no different. Now, that doesn't mean that all of them were engaged in sexual acts, because we'll never know for sure. Obviously, the fellows that we found in a state of semi-dress or condoms nearby or totally naked, I think it's fair to say there was some sexual activity between them. But several of the men were fully dressed.
By December 1990, the media knew investigators were looking for not one, but two persons of interest. Marion detectives had announced they were looking for two women who were seen hitchhiking the night of July 4th after they had abandoned Sims' car near Ocala. When the car was found, there was blood on the seats, and the vehicle had been involved in a crash just before the women were seen walking down the road. One of the women was described as tall, maybe 5'8", with light blonde, stringy, shoulder-length hair and a tattoo on her arm. The other woman was described as 5'2", with darker hair and a stockier build. A sheriff's captain told this to the media, quote, "It's premature to say there is a serial killer right now, but we are at the point where we have to get the word out. Somebody or a group of people seems to be targeting these individuals." Volusia County Sheriff at the time was Bob Vogel. I asked him to reflect on the increased media attention on the case as it was still developing.
I think the media probably started to smell a serial murderer here, you know, especially when it dealt with women. And I think this was the first case in the country, in the United States, where we had a serial murder at large, especially being a woman, which is quite unusual. The media, you know, media always has its ups and downs, you know, for those of us in the public sector. But when it comes time to develop assistance and so forth in capital murder cases, you know, we look to the media to assist us. You know, we can't hold information that could be vital to the apprehension of somebody in lieu of disrespecting the media. I mean, it's important because they do have a role in our community where they can help and assist us at times. And, you know, you play back and forth. Good media, bad media, sad.
All of the victims were white and in the age range of 43 to 65. All were shot with small caliber handguns. They had been traveling long distances. In most cases, their bodies were found in an area away from where their cars were found. Each victim appeared to have been robbed. Originally, law enforcement had linked 8 killings to the hitchhikers, the Angels of Death, but they eventually ruled one of them out after discovering someone else had committed that murder. Damore told me that he thinks Warnos likely killed 8 or 9 victims during her rampage, but in the end, she was linked to 7. In spite of the volume of bodies, Damore tends to bristle at the serial killer moniker being applied to Warnos.
I don't know how that fits into the serial killer mold. I mean, it makes for better TV. It makes for a better story. But if you think about it, when you talk about female serial killers, you're saying that most of them kill people they know. Well, I don't think there's all that many documented cases of female serial killers. And certainly 30 years ago, there really weren't. So I may be the doubting Thomas, and I may be 100% incorrect, but who am I to stand against the full weight and power of the news media? certainly, you know, when she got dubbed that, that was what it was going to be. As a prosecutor, it didn't matter to me whether they dubbed her a serial murderer or just a single murder. A murder was a murder. She just happened to do more of them than most people did. And a lot of it, if you think about it, her financial circumstances lended towards what? Robbing.
During the latter part of 1990, detectives in Marion and elsewhere across Central Florida were getting calls about sightings of the two hitchhikers all over the country, as far away as the Midwest and Northeast. Authorities in Volusia County received tips that the women may have been in the Port Orange area. In fact, there were 5 reports of women matching the descriptions of the Angels of Death hitchhiking, walking along Interstate 95 near the interchange at State Road 44. Deputies at one point searched the area for 2 hours with a helicopter, a dog, and road patrols, but came up empty. In spite of the massive disappointment of not getting their women, it turned out to be a solid lead for investigators. Here again is Bob Vogel.
Well, I remember the arrest. That evening, our investigators with the Sheriff's Office, Marion County, I think FDLE investigator was there, and I got a call from one of our investigators who said that they had tracked Eileen Warnos to the Last Resort Bar in Harbor Oaks, which is just south of Port Orange. I think maybe in the city of Port Orange now. And they were conducting surveillance on her at that point. And they had enough information, basically, from the pawn shop, from the fingerprints left on the paperwork at the pawn shop, that they could pin Eileen Warnos to the pawning of Mallory's personal items. So they waited, and after she came out of the Last Resort Bar, they took her down on US 1. That's when I got the call that she had been arrested, and they were transporting her to our operations center for interviewing and so forth and processing her.
Eileen Carol Warnos, known to everyone as Lee Warnos, was arrested, and she eventually admitted to the killings. Warnos was 34 years old when she was arrested. She was a transient prostitute who, according to various media reports, lured her victims with offers of sex. In a videotaped interview in mid-January 1991, she admitted to killing Richard Mallory and others. Authorities took an inventory of what was missing from Mallory's car. Those items included luggage, a black briefcase, a gold watch, a 35mm camera, a Polaroid camera, and a radar detector. It was learned that Warnos had pawned a camera and radar detector in Daytona Beach, and that's what led detectives to investigate her.
Yeah, the investigators, they worked diligently on the case. They pulled together all their resources, all the information that they had. They shared everything. It was all open, and they began accumulating all the information that was necessary to tie Eileen Warnos into the commission of all these murders.
Authorities had been chasing leads for more than a year. During the course of that investigation, law enforcement released to the media composite sketches of the women known as the Angels of Death. There were roughly 500 leads called in from the public, and one of them identified one of the women as Cammy Green. That name was found on a receipt for Mallory's camera and radar detector, which was pawned December 6, 1989. For $30 at a shop in Daytona. Green's thumbprint matched Warnos's thumbprint. The second half of the Angels of Death was Warnos's lover, Tyra Moore. She would play a significant role in obtaining murder charges against Warnos. She would be valuable to the prosecutors, too. Investigators tracked the pair to Harbor Oaks in Port Orange. Warnos was arrested January 9th at the Last Resort Bar in Port Orange on an outstanding warrant for a 1986 concealed weapons charge. By that time, Moore had already split from Warnos and relocated to Pennsylvania. She would not be charged. Authorities said they had never had any evidence pinning her to the murders. Here is David Damore talking about that.
Miss Moore, how would you describe her involvement? Was she a bystander?
I don't think Ms. Moore was fully aware of what Warnos did, but I do have a belief that, at least as to Mr. Mallory, she had to have known something was much worse than what she was being told, because Eileen came back with his Cadillac, and of course she didn't have it before she'd gone out on her jaunt to sell herself. I think she suspected it because she would come back with money. But I don't think ultimately she was a part of it. I'll never know. Never know for sure. One of the troubling things that not many people know is that she and Warnos, on one occasion, and we don't know whose car it was in, went up to Georgia and was actually identified at a pharmacy there buying some items. And I've always had this theory, because it was around the same time that Peter Sims went missing, that they might have been in Mr. Sims' car, gone up there, and that somewhere between Atlanta, which is where I think they had gone, And here, Mr. Sims had gotten put out into a marsh or God knows where. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, then my thoughts about Ms. Moore are completely wrong, and she was involved. It never came out. We never could establish that that's what happened. And ultimately, the decision was made to use her as a witness, not as a defendant. And with what we had as far as evidence that we could establish, as opposed to pure speculation, that's all she was a witness.
Moore said to investigators that Warnos told her on November 30th, 1989, that she was going to go out and find a, quote, customer. The following day, she returned to Moore in a 1977 Cadillac Coupe de Ville, beige in color. It was Mallory's car. She told Moore that she had killed a guy, shot him, and covered his body with a carpet. The blood inside the car was Mallory's. Detectives concluded he had been shot while seated behind the wheel. Moore would later lead investigators to the murder weapon, a .22 caliber handgun in Rose Bay, a body of water near Harbor Oaks, where the couple stayed. After she was arrested, Marion Sheriff's Captain Steve Beniger told the media, quote, "I believe Miss Warnos is a killer who robs, not a robber who kills." Before her arrest, Warnos blended in as best she could. She hung out and lived outside her favorite hangout in Port Orange, the Last Resort, which still exists today. It even has a section commemorating Warnos' regular visits there. In early 1991, Warnos would show up in shorts and a t-shirt and play music on the jukebox in the bar. One of her favorites was the Randy Travis song, "Digging Up Bones." On January 9th, police came in and arrested Eileen Warnos on a concealed weapons charge. 6 days following her arrest for that charge, she was charged in the shooting death of Richard Mallory. She came in to give her admission statements after a series of recorded calls with Moore. Detectives convinced Ty Moore to write a letter to Warnos with her phone number on it. Warnos, who never seemed to stop loving Moore, called her from jail. Between January 14th and 16th, 1991, police recorded 11 calls between Moore and Warnos. The two were estranged, but it was clear then and for the remainder of her life that Warnos was deeply in love with Moore. Whatever tenderness she had left in her soul came out of her when she talked about or was in the presence of Moore. Here are portions of those conversations. In one of them, Warnos started getting suspicious that others were listening in.
Hey, Ty?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Nothing. What the hell are you doing?
Nothing. I'm sitting here in jail.
Yeah, it's what I heard. There's been officials up at my parents' house asking some questions.
Uh-oh.
And I'm getting scared.
Listen, I gotta ask you something. Is there anybody in that room?
No, just me.
What?
What?
Is there anybody in your room?
No.
Ray Cass, a public defender who was assigned to the Warnos case, told the Orlando Sentinel of Warnos, quote, "We have a person who had been on her own since she was 12 or 14 years old." He added that she had an unimaginably hard life and referred to her as a genuine object of pity. When reporters reached out to Warnos' classmates in Troy, Michigan, where she was from, no one could remember anything about her. Even as a child, she was a bit of a loner. She dropped out of school when she was in the ninth grade. There was one woman who knew her best, and it was the other half of the Angels of Death. It was Tyra Moore. It was no surprise that investigators leaned heavily on her to get what they wanted out of Warnos. Moore convinced Warnos that the cops were on her, and they were doing all they could to charge her with murder. Warnos did not want to see her ex-girlfriend get charged. She came forward and gave a video confession to investigators. During a pretrial hearing in December 1991, Warnos sobbed as she listened to her ex-girlfriend testify about cooperating with law enforcement. Moore talked about those 11 recorded calls. Moore said on the stand, quote, "I was scared of being arrested. I wanted to keep her talking about the offenses so that I would be cleared." Here again is David DeMoor talking about Tyra Moore, the witness.
She was a pleasant person. She did nothing to offend me. She was cooperative. She was consistent. she was credible. I don't think she wanted to do what she did. I think it was painful to her. But I think she was still, even during the trial, driven by the fear that she could get in trouble. And she got up there, and I think she told the truth. In fact, I believe she told the truth. And it was consistent with everything we had developed up to that time she testified.
Warnos was born in Rochester, Michigan, and lived most of her upbringing in Troy, a suburb of Detroit. The year she dropped out of school in 1971, her mother, also named Eileen, died at 54 from an alcohol-related illness. Warnos was sent to a reform school for girls, but that didn't help her. Her father committed suicide 5 years after her mother died, and her brother died of cancer just 4 months after her dad died. Warnos, who was raised by her grandparents, was already acting out at a young age. She lived in Colorado for a time in the 70s and got into some trouble there. In 1991, after she moved to Volusia County, she was arrested on allegations of robbing an Edgewater convenience store with a .22 caliber handgun. Her attorney in that case wondered whether she was mentally competent enough to stand trial. He suspected then that she was out of touch with reality. She subsequently pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 3 years in prison. She served less than half that sentence before being released. She remained in Volusia County and racked up a litany of other criminal charges: forgery, trespassing, grand larceny, resisting arrest, and more. The killings had stopped after Warnos' arrest in January 1991. She was in jail and not getting out. In spite of that, public interest in the case did not wane. Lots of stories were being published about her in newspapers in Tampa, Orlando, Ocala, and Daytona Beach. Nationally televised tabloid shows kept airing segments. In August 1991, the Associated Press published a story about a Volusia County jail guard hearing a confession from Warnos, in which she said she was doing some good, killing her victims. She said they deserved to die because somewhere down the line, they were all going to hurt somebody else. That was a story she stuck to. Warnos went on to tell the jailer that she was a professional call girl who had been with as many as 250,000 men across 8 years. If that were true, she would have had sex with about 85 men a day, or more than 4.7 men per hour if you factor in 6 hours of sleep per day. During her conversation with the jailer, she went on to say she had been raped numerous times and just got sick of it. She proudly called herself a killer of rapists. Warnos also had said a lot during her taped confession with detectives. She rambled and changed subjects and would jump in various different places in the timeline, so the transcript was virtually useless to the prosecution. However, they managed to accumulate piles of evidence against Warnos. Here is a sample of what Warnos said during her taped confession with detectives. The quality of the audio from that conversation is poor, so I can't use it here, but I'll read you a few snippets. Warnos said of killing Mallory, quote, "So I started fighting with him, and I got my bag, and I shot him. And then when I shot him the first time, he just backed away, and I thought to myself, well, hell, should I, you know, try to help this guy? Or should I just kill him? So I figured, well, if I help the guy and he lives, he's going to tell on me, and I'm going to get arrested for attempted murder, all this jazz. And I thought, well, the best thing to do is just keep shooting him." Here's what she said about killing David Spears. "He wanted to go in the back of the truck, and all I remember is that I think there was some kind of lead pipe or something like that. When I got back there, he started getting vicious with me. I jumped out of the truck and he jumped out of the truck. I opened the door, grabbed my bag, grabbed the gun out, and I shot him, quick as possible. I shot him at the tailgate of the truck." Finally, this is what she said of killing Peter Sims. "When I shot him, after I was done, I went rifling through his stuff. I couldn't believe all the Bibles I found. I don't know if he was a minister or not, but if he was, I feel sorry for him, because why would he want to do something like that to me if he was so much into the Lord?" She also talked more about killing Karskadon, Burris, Humphreys, and Antonio. For the last victim, she admitted to shooting him once, causing him to fall into the ground, and then shooting him again after he got up and tried to run away. She shot him in the back. Coming up, you'll hear about Warnos' trial from a reporter who was there, and I'll also discuss Warnos' execution from another reporter who was outside the prison when it took place.
You know, there have been serial killers, female serial killers in the past, as far back as I think in the 1800s, women that were poisoning men or burying them in their cellars or nurses. But this was someone who was on the streets and picking up men and killing them. And before Eileen Warnos, that was something you never heard of. It was definitely, she was, became infamous for that reason.
That was Joe Callahan, longtime reporter with the Ocala Star-Banner, a man who wrote about the executions of both Ted Bundy and Eileen Warnos. You'll hear more from him later. She was facing many trials, and the first one was for the murder of her first victim, Richard Mallory. It was held in January 1992 inside a small courtroom in DeLand, located in West Volusia, about 30 minutes west of Daytona Beach. That first trial, predictably, was an atmosphere unlike any other in Florida since Ted Bundy's trial 13 years earlier in Miami. Local TV and print media were there, along with Reuters, Vanity Fair, and even media from Germany and the United Kingdom. TV tabloid shows had also been all over this story. Laura Burns covered the trial for the Ocala Star-Banner. She was known then as Laura Kaufman. Here she is talking to me about the craziness of that first trial.
I'm not sure whether it was intentional, because I think media circus cannot begin to describe. Galland was just taken over. Everywhere you looked were the big TV, you know, trucks with the satellites on them and everything, everywhere parked in. I mean, it attracted so much media, but the courtroom did not accommodate. It was very small, it was very uncomfortable, and they had basically two lines. One line was for the public, and that was for the right part of the courtroom when you walked in, and the left side of the courtroom was for the media. And if you weren't in line and in kind of, you know, close to the front in line by, I would say, 7 o'clock in the morning, you probably weren't going to get in. And if you left your seat to, I don't know, use the facilities or something, you weren't going to, you'd have to get back in line to get in and wait for someone else to give up a seat.
Burns vividly remembers the pretrial phase of the case because for one or more of her stories leading up to that trial, she had to call people on the witness list and interview them. And she got a lot of great interviews by making those calls.
And I will tell you that what really sticks out in my mind is making those calls and saying, hi, I'm Laura Kaufman with the Star-Banner, and do you know why you're on the witness list? And there was one woman, Susan Blahovic, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but she said, oh, the police have found my stolen driver's license. And I was like, what? And Warnos had, under a different alias, had sort of come to Key West and basically stole this woman's driver's license, birth certificate, registration, all that, and used it for part of her aliases. And this poor woman, every now and then, tickets would pop up on her driver's license. She didn't understand what that was going on. And one day, when the trail was getting really hot on Warnos, a bunch of FBI agents blocked her from leaving her home, blocked her driveway, and thinking she was the serial killer. And she had to prove with her work records that she was not, in fact, in the Florida, North Central Florida area at the time of these killings. So that was really interesting because she had no idea. I was the one who broke to her that Warnos had her driver's license. I mean, I can, if I recall correctly, she had not heard of Warnos. She was in the dark. I don't understand why, when the federal agents stopped her and, you know, and she proved who she was, why they didn't mention how that was connected with this case in Florida. And that, when they stopped her, I think, I want to say she was up in Ohio. But apparently, I mean, from what she told me, this was all news to her. She was surprised. She said, oh, you're calling me because they finally arrested the person who stole my ID. It's like, well, sort of, yes. That is, in fact, true, but that is not why I'm calling you. So that was her statement to me on the phone. It was news to her.
There were a lot of top-notch reporters covering the case, Burns being among them, as was Robert Nolan, formerly of the News Journal and Sun Sentinel, who's been a guest on this show before. Also covering it was Jeff Brazil, who was working for the Orlando Sentinel at the time. It was there that he won a Pulitzer Prize. Some of his stories about the Warnos trial read like poetry. Here is how he led his first story about the Warnos trial in Volusia. At 51, Richard Mallory was a temperamental loner with a penchant for strip bars and an ongoing beef with the Internal Revenue Service. Eileen Carol Warnos, age 34, was a prostitute with a checkered past, as bitter as she was lonely. Somewhere between Daytona Beach's seedy strip of bars along U.S. Highway 1 and the deserted stretch of Interstate 4 leading out of Tampa, Mallory and Warnos met each other for the first and last time. Warnos's attorneys for that first trial were Trish Jenkins and Bobby Nolas. They portrayed Richard Mallory as a John who took his kink too far. He looked to degrade Eileen Warnos, which pushed her over the edge due to the years of abuse she had endured throughout her life up to that point. That's what they told jurors. During her opening statements, Jenkins told jurors, quote, she had had enough. Not one more time could she take it. Not one more time. John Tanner, who prosecuted the case along with Dave Damore, and who also has been a guest on this show previously, painted a completely different picture of the defendant. Mallory picked up a hitchhiker that day, not realizing the danger he was facing. Tanner told jurors, quote, he didn't know he was living the last days of his life. He didn't know that in less than 10 hours, he would be robbed and murdered. Tanner went on to say about the defendant, quote, her appetite for lust and control had taken a lethal turn. During the trial, Tyra Moore took the stand. She was the star witness everyone had been anticipating. Warnos, as expected, was emotional seeing Moore on the stand. Moore did her best not to make eye contact with her until the end, when she glanced at her and smiled. Dave Damore handled the direct examination of Moore, who had a clear recollection of seeing Warnos after she came home from killing Richard Mallory. Moore said Warnos told her that she had just killed a man. At the time, Moore did not want to believe her girlfriend committed murder and told her not to talk about it. Damore asked her, quote, did she ever advise you that the man she had shot did anything to her? Moore told Damore emphatically that she did not. She also told Damore that in no time did Warnos tell her she had been beaten, raped, or otherwise tormented by Mallory or anyone else. She also didn't look bothered or upset. Defense attorneys did their best to paint Moore as someone who was not just manipulated by detectives, but also as someone who had clear motivation to become a state's witness. She was only doing what she was doing to clear her name. Moore conceded that she wanted to clear her name. She was genuinely fearful of going to jail and didn't hide it. But prosecutors said time and again, there was simply no evidence that she was involved in any of the killings. They believed she was a credible witness. Ultimately, jurors did too. Damore explained to me that the judge in the case permitted the state's use of the Williams rule, which allows for evidence from similar cases to be introduced to show a pattern of crime. That meant that Warnos's attorneys, even though Warnos was only being tried for one of the murders, had to contend with evidence from all the other slayings. There were limitations as to what the state could tell jurors, but it still wound up being a significant blow to the defense. The judge ultimately had no choice to allow for that evidence to be presented because Warnos testified. Once she did that, it opened the door for the state to present viable rebuttal testimony and evidence. Here again is David Damore.
When she testified, finally, I said, thank God, because up until then, I didn't know what the jury was going to do. I didn't know if we were going to get a conviction out of it, or the jury would say, hey, that was a reasonable doubt. She says she was being raped. The state can't prove that really she wasn't, even though she didn't say it fully, and there was no marks on her to back it up. She could have been found not guilty. But when she led into the self-defense, we were able to convince the judge based upon the similarity of each of the crimes, the nature of the crime, the manner of the crime, the type of weapon was used, the men, the locations, the circumstances, the timeline. And based upon that, there were enough similarities of those other cases that the judge said you can introduce, though on a limited basis, information about those cases. And that was mine to do. And I went through that like literally a whirlwind. And that's when we were putting on all of the other homicides, how they occurred. And of course, as you put on the second homicide, you're chipping away at the self-defense. And then you put the medical examiner on, say, for the third homicide, and the medical examiner establishes, no, this victim was a distance away, was shot in the back. The first shot paralyzed him. It was not a threat to anybody. And then was shot in the back of the head after the first shot. Guess what? Self-defense is really getting chewed up.
The trial was painstaking for all the parties involved. One witness who got to Damore the most was Stephen Sims, the adult son of Peter Sims. The body of Peter Sims was never found, but his car was. Inside the car were items belonging to the victim. Stephen Sims was shown some of those items, and he was asked to identify them. One item in particular was a hairbrush.
The hairbrush ultimately will be identified by his son during the trial. And it was one of those things where I didn't know it was going to have this emotional effect on me, but as I walked up to him, I asked him if he could identify any of these objects, and I held out the hand brush, and he took it in his hand, and he just stopped for a moment. And I could tell he was more troubled than he had been before I handed him the hand brush. And tears welled up in his eyes, and he said, I know this hairbrush. This is the brush my father would brush my hair with when I was a little boy. And I have to tell you, at that point, I had not been emotional once in that trial. That hit me like a lead weight between my eyes, and I started to feel like I was going to bawl. Because, you know, you have the pressure of these trials, and, you know, you're, at that stage, you're kind of getting to the end, and you're wrapping up, and all that pressure of preparing, and the worry, you know, will you get the conviction? Will something go wrong? Will there be a mistrial? Will you make a mistake that causes this, you know, woman to go free? You know, will the jury understand that the way you believe the facts are? But when he said that, I almost lost it. And I had to literally kind of stagger back to my desk and compose myself because I was about to start crying.
Stephen Sims lived in Arkansas when his dad died. Peter Sims was on his way to see his son when he was killed. Another significant moment of the trial for the prosecution was the testimony of Bobby Kopus. He was someone who had his own scary encounter with Warnos on one rural highway in Central Florida. Here is Dave Damore telling me more about Kopus's interaction with Warnos.
There was a fellow named Bobby Kopus who became a witness in Eileen Warnos' case. He had just been literally been on I-4 heading back from a business meeting, had some cash on him from closing a deal, and saw a woman hitchhiking on the road. According to Bobby Kopus, she had given him a story that her car had broken down, she needed to get back to Daytona Beach to her children, and he gave her a ride. Along the way, as they were driving, she noticed he had some money up in his visor, which is where he kept his cash, and he noticed and saw a large handgun in a purse. And what ultimately happened is he pulled over ostensibly to go to the bathroom, was able to get her out of the car, and then he drove off. And according to Bobby Kopus, she hollered out at him, I'll kill you like I killed those other MFers. And ultimately, Mr. Kopus actually called me at my home and did not want to cooperate in the sense that he didn't want his wife to know he had picked this woman up, that she might not believe that it wasn't a sexual encounter. And it took me some real fancy talking for quite some time on that phone to convince him to give me his name and his phone number, because we didn't have phone ID 30 years ago. And he became a very important witness in the case. So I think it ought to be clear to the listeners that sex is not linked to all of these cases. And it very well may be that more men than not actually thought they were picking up a hitchhiker, helping a woman to get from one area to the other. And she pulled out the gun on him. And at that point, what are you going to do? You got a gun pointed at you. You go where they tell you to go. So something to consider.
That moment Kopis had with Warnos happened November 5th, 1990, 2 weeks before the body of her final victim was discovered. Near the end of the trial was when Warnos took the stand. Here is how Jeff Brazil of the Orlando Sentinel wrote the top of his story from that day of the trial. The defense in the Eileen Warnos murder case called its one and only witness Friday. In the end, it may have been one witness too many. During her cross-examination, which was handled by John Tanner, Warnos said she covered Mallory's body with the scrap of carpet liner because she didn't want the birds to be pecking at his body. Many of her comments, like that one, made jurors shift in their seat. Fireworks were going off left and right throughout the trial. Damore told me he and Billy Nolis, one of Warnos' defense attorneys, did not get along. Things were so volatile between the two of them in court that the judge in the case asked for a roll of packing tape. After a bailiff re-entered the courtroom with the tape, the judge set it in front of him on the bench, essentially threatening to use it on the next attorney who spoke out of turn. Perhaps no one had a bigger outburst than the defendant herself after the guilty verdict was read. It took jurors 90 minutes to return with that verdict. Here is David Damore recalling what Warnos said to them as they were filing out of the courtroom after the guilt phase of the trial was over.
She looked at him, screamed at them. This was not a gigantic courtroom. Even if it had been, you would have heard that two hallways away. Oh, yeah. She looked up at him and gave it to him. And she had to be basically pulled out of the room.
So she was still in the courtroom.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the judge was still on the bench. She was being led by two bailiffs in there, and she stopped, turned. Jurors were all seated. I'm literally from here. She's over there. The juror's right over here. And I was raped. I hope each of you get raped. You know, something like that. I don't remember the exact words, but it was vociferous, and it was angry, and her eyes were bulging. It was vintage Eileen Warnos bugging out.
The judge knew something was coming. That's why jurors were exiting through the door to the judge's chambers, which was a closer exit. Warnos had her long-awaited explosion in court. Here is the actual audio of Warnos yelling at jurors.
I was raped. I hope you get raped. Scumbag governor.
During the penalty phase of the trial, the man Warnos knew in childhood as her big brother was called to the stand. He wasn't there to give mitigating testimony to keep her off death row. Instead, he was there to testify against her. Barry Warnos described his family to jurors as pretty straight and narrow, not at all like what his sister had described. Eileen Warnos had long alleged that her father abused her. Barry Warnos said that wasn't true. The defendant was demonstrative while her brother testified. She pounded the table and gestured wildly to her attorneys. The odd thing about all of it was that Barry wasn't really her brother, but her uncle. Eileen was abandoned by her parents as a child, so she had to be raised by her grandparents, who happened to be Barry's parents. Barry Warnos said he never contacted Eileen after her arrest because there was no reason for him to do so. He also said he turned away the media each and every time they reached out to talk to him. He had nothing to say. His testimony was another axe blow to the defense's attempt to build up Eileen Warnos as a sympathetic figure. Jurors, predictably, recommended death for her. They were unanimous. Many of them teared up. One of them told the Orlando Sentinel, quote, I don't dislike the woman. I feel sorry for her. She added that she had no choice but to follow the evidence. Warnos had other trials, and they all had the same result: guilty on all counts and death. In May 1992, less than 4 months after she was sentenced to death in DeLand, a judge handed down three more death sentences to Eileen Warnos in Ocala. After the sentences were read, she said to the judge and to the prosecutors, "Thank you. I'll go to heaven now, and you will all rot in hell." She turned to one prosecutor in particular and said to him, "May your wife and kids get raped." Warnos's demeanor for that trial was far less restrained compared to the trial in Volusia County. Here again is Laura Burns.
Now, when she was in the DeLand courtroom, things did start off, much more sweetness and light. She was just dressed very, was what we call a Peter Pan collar, you know, rounded collar, buttoned to the top. She had a war crucifix. She would turn around, and when she spotted Arlene, she would, you know, wave or, mouth, "I love you," and that kind of stuff. Things went sour, definitely, for her.
Arlene Prally, who Laura Burns just referenced, was Warnos's adoptive mother and her biggest supporter during her trials. She was a regular attendee for all of Warnos's hearings and would eagerly take interviews and would audibly weep whenever a ruling or anyone's testimony went against Warnos. Laura Burns had made a good impression on Arlene, maybe too good of an impression.
And kind of odd, ironically, for some reason, Arlene liked me a lot, and that would cause a few issues when we would be at the different trials or the pretrial hearings and everything. She would run up and give me a hug, and I would say, you can't do that, because, it looks a little strange, and it puts the wrong idea. I tried my very best to be as objective as possible, and when the adopted mother of the serial killer who was eventually convicted on all seven and put to death is hugging Anya, that the prosecutors maybe look askance at that. But that was a little strange.
Arlene Prally is just another part of a very crazy case. But like with mostly every murder trial, there is the palpable grief felt by the victim's family. In this case, there were seven such families. Dick Humphrey's widow was in the courtroom during that trial in Ocala. She was shaken by Warnos's courtroom behavior and her statements. She said if God ever forgives her for her husband's killer, he is, quote, much more magnanimous than I am. Warnos was convicted in six more murders. She got death sentences for all of them. Warnos, seemingly resigned to her fate, did her best to cancel her appeals, but her attorneys kept filing them. On October 8, 2002, Eileen Warnos gave her last interview. It was with Nick Broomfield, a British documentary filmmaker. Here is a portion of what Warnos said to Broomfield in that interview.
I'm all right with it, but like I said, remember and let them know that I know that the cops knew who I was after Richard Mallory died. I left prints everywhere, and they covered it up and let me kill the rest of those guys to turn me into a serial killer. I know they did, because I was no professional serial killer or anything. Murderer, or whatever you want to call it, you know. It wasn't special at what I was doing.
Eileen, how...
I did some sloppy work, you know, and I left...
How have you prepared yourself for tomorrow morning?
I'm all right with it. Yeah, I'm ready to go.
The interview lasted about 30 minutes. It would have lasted longer, but Warnos couldn't keep her temper under control. During her rant, she actually mentioned the year 2019 being the year that the United States would cease to exist.
Thanks a lot. I lost my f***ing life because of it. Couldn't even get a fair trial. Couldn't even get a fair investigation or nothing. Couldn't even have my appeals right. You sabotaged my ass, society, and the cops and the system. A raped woman got executed and was used for books and movies and s***. Ladder climbs, re-election, everything else. I got a big finger in all your faces. Thanks a lot. You're inhuman. You're an inhumane bunch of f***ing living bastards and bitches. And you're going to get your asses nuked in the end. And pretty soon it's coming. 2019, Iraq's supposed to hit you anyhow. You're all going to get nuked.
The interview ended after Warnos made an obscene gesture and stormed out of the room. Broomfield would later say that by the time she was executed, Warnos was clearly insane. 10 years on death row made her shaky mental condition even worse. In spite of people's conviction that Warnos was too mentally ill to be put to death, on October 9th, 2002, Eileen Warnos's death sentence was carried out. Among those who covered the execution, but who stayed outside and wrote about what he saw, among the opponents of the death penalty and those who wanted to see her dead, was Joe Callahan of the Ocala Star-Banner. He had done the same almost 14 years earlier, while working for the paper in Lake City, covering the Ted Bundy execution.
I had been to the Bundy execution in 89. I was expecting it to be more of the circus it was for Bundy, but really, in my mind, it had a more subdued atmosphere, more people who were not as emotional as Bundy, but, you know, carried signs but weren't as loud and rambunctious. And a lot of the mental health proponents were there to protest the execution, because in the weeks leading up to it, Jeb Bush stayed the execution to get some more input from mental health experts. And when they came back and all said that she was competent, that she knew what she was doing when she killed these men, he waived the stay and the execution proceeded. But there was many people there who was protesting the execution, not that she was a good person and should not be executed, but the mental health aspect of it.
Inside Florida State Prison, the mood, as is always the case whenever there's an execution, was somber. Strapped to a gurney, Warnos smiled at the witnesses who were watching from the other side of a glass window. Before she was administered the lethal injection, her last words were this: "I'd like to say I'm sailing with the rock, and I'll be back, like Independence Day, with Jesus, June 6th, like in the movie, big mothership and all. I'll be back." After an execution, witnesses are invited to the media tent to speak. The families of the victims came away satisfied that Warnos was dead, but less than satisfied with the manner of death.
But the family afterwards did say that, you know, by this time the electrocution was no longer, it was a lethal injection, and the families of the men she killed, one family member said they should have suffered a little bit more. She should have suffered a little bit more because she just was given a lethal injection and went to sleep, where that wasn't the case for her victims.
At the last resort, the Port Orange Bar where Warnos was arrested, 24 or so patrons toasted the execution when it was announced. The following morning, they ate pastries and drank coffee. A chalkboard was used to count down the days to her execution, and on the morning after, the word "gone" was written big in chalk. Callahan told me that the Eileen Warnos case never ceased to capture people's attention. It's a case that people still regularly bring up. It's not just because Warnos was a female prostitute who hunted and killed men, but also because she fueled a raging debate about mental competence and the death penalty.
Well, there's no doubt that's what made this story so fascinating for everyone in the country, and especially in our area, is that a female serial killer on the loose was interesting, and she was interesting until the end. I mean, it turned out to be one of the more interesting cases of killers that I've been associated with.
Eileen Warnos's appearance was part of a story. She had a piercing glance. Her angry expressions evoked fear in people. Her face also represented the years of hard abuse she endured from other people, as well as the self-inflicted abuse.
You know, and it's in contrast to when she was a young girl. She was very pretty, even when she was younger, very, you know, pretty pretty, but just hard life and hard drinking and bad things took their toll on her, definitely.
David Damore stood and sat mere feet from Warnos for weeks during her trial in DeLand. He got many long looks at her.
Eileen was a big woman. Could tell she had a hard life. Muscular, thick neck, not attractive. Again, I don't hold that against her, but she just simply was not attractive. Had very strange eyes, eyes that looked like they had killed.
He kept going.
Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It would be very hard for me to think of how anyone could see beauty or behold beauty in the form of Eileen Warnos, based upon her stature, her demeanor, and her just her presentation of herself.
Bob Vogel, who was Volusia County Sheriff from 1989 until 2001, is among those who never ceases to wonder why so many notorious killers wind up in or near Volusia County. Warnos was here. Gary Ray Bowles was here. Otis Toole lived in West Volusia for a time. David Allen Gore killed his victims one county south of here. There was Gerald Stano, who murdered dozens of people in Volusia. There was Oba Chandler, who killed his victims in Tampa Bay, but lived in Port Orange. Even Ted Bundy got close. He had tried to abduct a teenage girl in Jacksonville, about 90 miles north of here.
Well, having lived in Volusia County for a long, long time, and seeing that we, for some reason, I don't know why, but we attract these, you know, Bundy, Stano, you know, we get these serial murderers here, Eileen Warnos. Why we are attracting them, or why they're attracted to us, I don't know, but it just seems bizarre. And they come from Washington State. I mean, as far away as you could possibly be, they come to Florida, you know. Can't figure that out. I wish somebody could put a mark on the map. Don't come here, you know. I don't know.
A year after Warnos' death, the film Monster came out. It wasn't a blockbuster, but it got a lot of attention, largely because of Charlize Theron's performance and the fact that Theron, known for her beauty in addition to her acting ability, went through a transformation to resemble Warnos. It was an uncanny resemblance. In spite of the buzz around that film and the fact that it's 16 years old and can be streamed anywhere, most of the people I have spoken to about this case have never seen it. Laura Burns, for sure, did not want to relive it.
I did not. No. Didn't want to dwell on it. It really took up a lot of my life and a lot of my bandwidth, and it was horrible. I mean, she was not somebody you wanted to spend more time with, and in a courtroom or in any other way. No, I feel like I lived it firsthand. I don't need to see how, you know, Hollywood or somebody puts it together.
Bob Vogel did not want to see it either. He objected to Hollywood shining a brighter light on the killer and not the victims.
I never watched it. I don't, you know, for me personally, I had no desire to watch it, and I thought it, you know, I'm not into that type of industry where you, you know, market stuff. I was just, you know, having my law enforcement side is more empathetic towards the victims and their family, and seeing that justice is proceeds with, especially in these serious cases.
Even David Damore wouldn't watch it. In his mind, Eileen Warnos did not warrant the kind of sympathy that the filmmakers seemed to have for her.
Did you see the movie Monster?
I did not.
Oh, okay. So why did you decide not to?
I kind of heard about it as to how they had portrayed it in Hollywood. And I was kind of disappointed that they made her out to be something that she really was not. Yeah, she had a hard life, but you know, lots of people in our society have very hard lives. They don't turn to murdering people as a result of that. I'm a fan of the actress who played it, and I know she did an exceptional job. She got an Academy Award for it. You know, Charlize Theron, that could be made to look the way I guess that she was made to look. But there was no, look, it wasn't intended to be a documentary. It was intended to be a Hollywood description, and Hollywood, as they sometimes do, lose sight of the facts. You know, I felt that the victim's stories were the stories of Eileen Wuornos' story, and they made her kind of a somewhat sympathetic figure, and I didn't think she deserved that. I thought that was not respectful to the men and the families that had killed her. So I had no interest in it.
Thank you for listening. I wanted to take this time to let all of you know that this is my final episode as the host of Sun Crime State. It remains to be seen whether the show will go on with a different host, but I'm moving on. I need to thank my editor, John Gallis, for allowing me to do this during the past 2 years. When I pitched him the idea, it didn't dawn on me or him how successful it would become. We've taken the show to heights we didn't expect. Nearly 400,000 downloads across the world. That's across 76 episodes. I also wanted to thank News Journal digital editor Chris Bridges for regularly taking the time out of his enormously busy schedule to produce this podcast. He gave me a lot of great advice and provided some much-needed technical assistance during the entire run of the show. Above all, I want to thank the listeners. This show managed to have an enormous reach. From Daytona Beach to Scandinavia. Mostly all of the feedback I received from you was positive, as well as constructive. I appreciate you all. Take care.
You can find Tony on Twitter at TonyCrimeWriter or email him at tony.holt@news-jrnl.com. Be sure to rate us on iTunes. Sun Crime State is recorded by Tony Holt and produced by Chris Bridges for the Daytona Beach News Journal.